Well, anytime a lesson starts with a warning, that's probably not the best thing, but here comes one. This might be a little bit of a unique lesson. In fact, it probably will be. I was asked about a month ago to address a congregation up north, and they gave me a topic that I would not have chose to speak on, and I was going to say a million years, but that's probably not true. I'd have probably got to it by that time. But it's not a topic that I would have naturally chose, but once I looked into it and studied it, I really found some benefit to it, and it's just something that sometimes it's good to look at things that you wouldn't normally look at. They asked me to address two questions, and that is, A, what is paganism? And B, how has paganism influenced modern Christianity? And that's not something that I would have naturally chosen to speak on, but I saw a lot of benefit in that, and so I've modified that lesson a little bit, and I'm going to share some of those thoughts with you. I'm almost certain that I shared this story with this group at one point, but it's stuck in my mind so much that when this topic came, it just popped into my head. There was a time about 3 years ago or so that I was attending a funeral, and I went to the funeral home, and it was a funeral of somebody within the Brotherhood of the Church of Christ, and as I pulled up, I parked right behind along a street behind a car that I saw some people get out of it. And without getting into too much detail, it looked to me by the way that they were dressed and just the way that they were carrying themselves that they were probably not going to be attending the same funeral that I was, even though it was in the same funeral home. And on the back of that car, I saw a bumper sticker, and it said three words. It said pagan and proud. And when I see things like that in my life, see things that blatantly fly in the face of the beliefs that I hold and the beliefs that I know that we hold in Christianity and God and things, I usually have one of two reactions. Either A, I get really angry, or B, I get really sad. And I don't know why sometimes, maybe it's just the mood that I'm in, but sometimes, you know, it just really infuriates you. And I saw that, and my heart just broke. Because I thought of the belief system that these people probably held and what had just transpired with, obviously, I'm going to assume a death of maybe somebody. Maybe that person didn't have those beliefs. I don't know. But I saw that. And A, I was surprised that it was in my country, my state, my city in, 2010. I didn't know that stuff was even around. And yet it is. Webster defines paganism as a follower of a polytheistic religion. The word pagan actually is derived from a Latin word paganos, which means country dweller. So it's kind of from the hills, kind of from the countries of these ancient religions. If you do a quick search on the internet of paganism, the first website that I came across was the Pagan Federation International. There actually is an International Federation of Paganism. And from their website, I'll just read very briefly some of the things that they adhere to. The Pagan Federation exists not to promote a single aspect or path within paganism, nor does it represent all pagans. Rather, it is an umbrella organization with a membership drawn from all strands. All pagans over the age of 18 are welcome to join, regardless of which pagan path they follow. They must, however, subscribe to these three principles. So there's many pagan paths, but you can be a member of this federation if you subscribe to these three things. And these are the three things that they adhere to. Number one, love for and kinship with nature and its ever-renewing cycles of life and death, a positive morality in which the individual is responsible for the discovery and the development of the true nature, so very much power within, self-discovery. Two, it's expressed as, do what you will as long as it harms none. And three, recognition of the divine which transcends gender, allowing both female and male aspect of deity. So basically, the three things that they have to adhere to is love and kinship with nature, do whatever you want as long as it doesn't harm anybody, and recognize that there's both male and female aspects of deity. And that is what paganism, at least today, is or subscribes to be. Polytheism has been around for a long time. The earliest account that I could find is Genesis 31 and 16, where Rachel takes idols from Laban's house. We don't know a whole lot about those idols. They would have been some sort of Assyrian gods of that time, probably, but we don't know exactly much about it. But it's been around a long time. Polytheism has been around a long time. And we know that it doesn't make God happy. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 24 is a very famous verse. If you don't know it by that, you know it by this. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire and a jealous God. God is jealous. Polytheism has been around a long time, and God has never liked it. a little bit more about what paganism is. Paganism is not Satanism. It's a very different thing. A pagan would not even acknowledge Satan, at least not in the realm that we believe, because that would acknowledge God and the Bible and some truth like that. So paganism does not acknowledge the existence of Satan, and so it is very different than Satanism. Within the Bible, there's roughly 34 gods that are listed, 34 false gods in the Old Testament and then partially in the New, mostly in the Old Testament, that's listed. And if I asked you to think of a false god in the Old Testament, you would probably come to that of Baal. Baal is mentioned over 90 times in the Bible, and just a little bit about him. And I found this a little bit interesting because it ties in a lot of the stories with respect to Elijah. It gave a little bit more meaning in my studies. Baal means Lord or owner. It's referenced, as I said, over 90 times in the Bible, and he is a fertility deity. There's two main sources of information that we have for Baal, and I didn't know this, but Baal was actually stolen from Babylon. So Baal actually came from the Babylonian religion, just like the Greeks stole a lot of things from the Romans. Here, the Canaanites stole this from the Babylonians. And there was to give a little bit of background about him and his origin, I guess, according to them, and this will bear out a little bit as I look into 1 Kings here in just a second. But essentially, there was two gods, a god of order and a god of disorder, and they had a big fight, and the god of order chopped the god of disorder in half. And they believed that this god of order split into two, one half became the heavens and one half became the earth. And that's why the nature and the weather and earthquakes and things like that, they thought that it was the result of this disorderly god that existed into heaven and earth. So the god of order saw this was a problem and created a bunch of sub-gods to combat this god of this chaos, this disorder. And one of those gods was Baal. Baal was the god of fertility, and he was created to combat the winter and to bring the spring. Now, when you think about that, that bears certain importance to 1 Kings 18 and 21, and I'll turn over there. 1 Kings 18 and the 21st verse. And this is kind of the famous showdown between Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And with this polytheistic or pagan beliefs that a lot of people had, and it infiltrated into the mindset of the Israelites here. In verse 21, Elijah said, and Elijah came to all the people and said, "How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, but if Baal, follow him." But the people answered him, and not a word. How long are you going to be split between these two? And at the time when they had accepted Baal, they hadn't completely in their mind rejected God. And this is a lesson I think we can draw from this. They were open themselves to polytheism, but it didn't necessarily shun Jehovah in the way that we might think that they did. They just welcomed and allowed other things in. Now, God obviously took that as rejection, and we can understand that and understand that so. But in their mind, they didn't reject God. They just allowed other things in. Well, I don't have a statue of a God with a bull's head like Baal or anything like that at my house. But when you think of that concept, not putting God to the side but just accepting other things in, that's something that can hit pretty close to home for us. Well, we didn't reject God. We still had his temple. We still worshiped him. But we also had this god of fertility to help the spring come through, to help the winter end. That didn't make God happy. If we turn over just to the next page, and this is another relatively famous passage, in 1 Kings 19, talking in verse 18, and this is when Elijah is concerned that he's all alone. And in 1 Kings chapter 19, 18 says, "Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel whose knees have not bowed to Baal." Elijah, you're not alone. There's 7,000 that haven't bowed to Baal. And I thought about that, and I'm like, you know, that's great. You know, 7,000 people, that's a lot of people. I've never been in a room with 7,000 people. But think about the flip side of that, though. How many people were in the nation of Israel at this time? I don't know either. I was hoping somebody would tell me the answer. A bunch, over a million people. There would have been over a million Israelites. And how many didn't? 7,000. So how many did? A whole lot. This was a huge problem at their time. at that time, and I hadn't really thought about it, but hundreds of thousands of people had bowed the knee to Baal. And that would have been frustrating. That would have been, and so you could understand why Elijah might have felt that way. And so we can maybe have similar feelings like that. You know, I mean, if we would just say that roughly the nation of Israel would have been about the size of the Kansas City metropolitan area, and yet only 7,000 remained faithful to the God that delivered them, I think that would have been a humbling thing. And so I found it interesting that these things that were blatantly against what they had known, blatantly against the law, blatantly against everything that they've been taught about what they should have their religion to be, but yet over time things eroded. As I was sitting in my seat, I just found it interesting, but both of what Bill and Dale said, a lot of it kind of tied in. Just when we get bombarded with things throughout society, things can erode away our desire or our, not necessarily our desire, but our affection for purity. Our affinity for purity. So what about today? There are a number of symbols, a number of things that are observed by, and I don't know how to use this term, but I just use it the best I can, Christian environments today that do, frankly, have some pagan origins. There's also a number of things in our society that have pagan origins. The 7 days of the week, each one of those days, Sunday, Monday, the names that we use are pagan in origin. Sunday is the day of the sun. Monday, the day of the moon. Tuesday is the day of Tiu, who is an English Germanic god of war. Wednesday was Woden, the Anglo-Saxon god of the wild hunt. Thursday, which I should have known, should have seen that one coming, Thursday, is the day of Thor, the god of thunder. That's what Thursday is. Friday is the day of Freya, F-R-E-Y-A, which is a goddess of love. And Saturday, the day of Saturn. I mean, there's pagan influences all over in everyday society. Now, I call those days, I've called Monday since I could talk. I'm not saying that's wrong. We use it as a means to communicate. And over time, things can change. Their meanings can change. Obviously, at some point, that would have been the day set aside for worship of the moon, but the hundreds and thousands of times that I've said Monday and talked to people about Monday, I don't know of a single person that has ever worshipped the moon on that day. So while it has those origins, that doesn't mean that it means the same thing now. There was a time in our history that we, by saying that we were from the state of Missouri, would have meant that we were from an area that condoned slavery. But that doesn't mean that now. And so things can change over time. So while these things may have had origin in this, it doesn't necessarily mean that they still do. But I think it's good to take a look at what it is that some of these things may have come from and maybe think and consider our own ways and how God would feel about it. A couple of symbols that are common in Christianity is the Celtic cross. That's have some debate as to whether or not it is or isn't pagan. And also, I don't even know the name of this symbol, but I just call it the Jesus fish. I don't know what else to call it, but I think you guys know what it is that I'm talking about. But that is fairly widely accepted as, originated as a pagan symbol of fertility. And so how did a pagan symbol of fertility come to mean Jesus? Well, I'm glad you asked. I found this to be incredibly interesting. In the Greek word for fish, and I'm not going to write it up, and I can't say it right, but it comes to be an acrostic. You know, like NASA or MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You know, it's a word, but then each letter stands for something. The Greek word for fish is I-C-H-T-H-Y-S. Ichthys is what I'm going to say. And if it's quite possible that early Christians took that word for fish and made an acrostic out of it, which is Eos Christos Theoios Soter, which means Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Savior. If you add a couple of H's in there, then you can get the Greek word for fish and a saying that says Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Savior. And it's thought that early Christians would have used that symbol, which would have been accepted in society as a way of identifying other Christians. So kind of an underground type thing that they would have used that symbol as a way to identify with each other that they were Christians. But that symbol in and of itself does have pagan origins. So what does that mean today? Well, I don't know. but I can give you my thoughts. I have more thoughts than I have answers, and that's fine. If I spur on more thinking than I answer questions, I'm completely okay with that. I certainly appreciate and understand and commend the sentiment of having a symbol like that displayed, because we see that in our society today. When we see that symbol, I don't think, and I don't think most people think of pagan fertility. Most people see that symbol and they think of Jesus. But that begs the question to me, why do we even have a symbol anyways? The Old Testament is riddled with rituals and riddled with symbols. If God wanted us to use these types of things, he would have done so. But when I look at the New Testament, the only symbols that I find are right over here. There's nothing wrong with having a bumper sticker wanting to say you're a Christian, but I don't know why you'd have to have a fish. Why don't you just say I'm a Christian? There's zero room for misconception or for misunderstanding. And I'm just... You did not do that. And I'm not coming down on that in any ways. I just think that it might be good for us to sometimes think about these things. I'm 100% certain that Christ would be pleased if there was a bumper sticker out there that said, I serve Christ. No doubt in my mind. And so it might just be easier or simpler for us to simplify things and not try to be as cute. God could have easily had us, you know, put crowns of thorns all about our places of worship, or he could have ordered us to have statues. There's a lot of religious organizations that have statues and paintings and things of all these kinds of people that were Christ himself or the apostles or all these kinds of things. But really what are those are just very poor representations of Christ and the apostles. Have you ever thought, and we all know this, and I don't know where it came from, but we all know the image of Jesus. You know, the Caucasian man with a beard and shoulder-length brown hair, and we all know, we see that picture, and we say, oh, look, you know, it's Jesus. Have you ever thought about what Jesus thinks of that picture? I know that's not what he looks like. I don't know what he does look like, but I know he's not that. So why do we ascribe these images? Why, God, it seems like God painstakingly put physical things into Old Testament worship, and then he removed them in New Testament worship. And so I don't understand why man has this need to try and re-inject these physical things back into it. We can turn to a number of scriptures. Hebrews 10:16, John 4:24, and Acts 17:29 all tell us that the law is written on our heart, that we're to worship in spirit and truth. And Acts 17:29, Paul talking in Mars Hill talks about how divinity is not like gold or silver or stone. Divinity is spiritual. Divinity is divine. And yet man seems to have this need to try and draw physical things back into it. I just don't see the use for them. God did away and systematically did away with ritualistics and a number of symbols, and I don't know that we need to bring them back into it. As I mentioned earlier, Deuteronomy 4:24 talks about how God is a jealous God, and so I think we ought to be mindful of that. We know that he's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And so if he was jealous at that time, he could be and is still jealous today. Lastly, and I'd like to address this, and I know that sometimes it's shied away from, and I know sometimes it can be a little bit of a touchy subject, but just because something's touchy doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about it. Getting back to paganism, pagans have 8 major festivals. And 4 of them have to do with the equinox and the solstice, being the shortest and longest days of the year, and then the 2 days of the year that the day and the night are the same length. They have about, and then they have 4 other Celtic festivals that they observe. And 3 of those festivals have traditionally been brought forward into common day American society. And there's no real 2 ways about that. Now I can talk a little bit about it in a second, but those 3 major festivals that have been transitioned are that of Halloween, Christmas, and Easter. Halloween, October 31st, is the Nordic year end. So as it transitions from October 31 into November 1st, that's the end of the year transitioning into the new year. And it was called back then the day between the years. There's a common belief that the dead would walk among the living, and the veils between the past and present and the future were lifted. And so with prophecy and divination and things like that you could see into the future and communicate with the dead. And that is where the origins of Halloween comes from. Now, today we have little cute Superman and Spider-Man. They ring doorbells and get candy. But the origins of that were pagan in nature. Christmas. Christmas was a festival shortly right after the shortest day of the year. It was the very shortest day, the least amount of daylight in the day. And so Christmas was surrounded around a pagan festival to try and appease the gods to make them increase the length of time afterwards. They would offer, not necessarily sacrifices, but bring offerings to these gods to try and ensure that, make sure that the days would get longer, that they would have a spring and a good harvest. Celebrating the 12 days of Yule involved decorating pine trees. And then also that of Easter. Easter was a fertility festival that originated in May, which is where both the symbols of eggs and bunnies come into to play with the celebrating of Easter, because as you can probably imagine, eggs and bunnies would be natural symbols for fertility. It had to do with Eustora, a German fertility goddess. Now, I'm not here to say these things are necessarily right or wrong. I'm just here to present facts and let us consider them. That there are a lot of organizations out there that hold up these 2 days as very, very Christian happenings. And I'm just wanting to clearly state that December 25th is not the birthday of Christ, nor is Easter the resurrection of Christ. Now, as we've talked about symbols changing and things like that, and so as one time decorating a pine tree might have been satisfying some sort of pagan god, now when I see a pine tree with ornaments on it, I think of annoying music and crazy shopping. Because, you know, symbols change and symbols are only as powerful as the meaning that we ascribe to them. So I'm not saying anything here or there, but I'm just saying that these aren't, they never originated as, and I don't think should be observed as, inherently Christian holidays. They aren't. Now, there's nothing wrong with observing Christ's birth or observing the resurrection of Christ. We just did that. And we should do that. But that doesn't have anything to do with eggs or bunnies or pine trees. Nor should it. Sorry, I got on a roll there. So, I said that this wasn't going to be a normal lesson, and that's, I guess that's fine. My goal is for us to think about things and to look at things. And we do things different than even the mainstream Christianity, and we should make no apologies for it. But I think we should maybe understand some of the things also that where the origins come from. I don't mind people drawing conclusions that they're convicted in their heart about, but it does trouble me sometimes when people are just ignorant of things. I think it's good for us to understand where things come from and then draw our own conclusions from that. Paganism, to my surprise, actually is growing. It's one of the fastest growing religions. Not so much in America; it's more in Europe than it is here. But it is in the world today. It is increasingly growing. And on a percentage basis, it's still relatively small. But I was shocked at how much of it is still out there. There's YouTube videos out there and things like that of these people talking about the things that they do. And I don't recommend watching them at all. But it was just a few of them I found to be interesting. But I'd like to turn to Ephesians, the 4th chapter, as I draw my thoughts to a close. Ephesians, the 4th chapter, starting in verse 4. There is one body, one spirit, just as you were called, and one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. Verse 7. But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Grace was given to us according to the measure of Christ's gift. When I think about the amount of grace that I've been given in my life, it's humbling. So I think of times that I haven't done always the right thing, and I know that the gift of Christ covers those sins, that I can't spread my arms wide enough to demonstrate the amount of grace that the Lord and Christ have given to me. And we should always remember that there is only one body, that there is only one baptism, and there is only one path to heaven. Despite what we get bombarded with, despite this preaching of tolerance and acceptance, and the second tenet of this pagan federation was that do what you want as long as it harms no one. What's the harm in that? Well, there certainly is. I was reading a book recently by C.S. Lewis, and sometimes, as I'm sure most of us are probably familiar with him as an author, sometimes he writes things that I think are brilliant, and then sometimes he frustrates me. So I guess he's Same thing could be said by about a lot of people. But in his book, The Great Divorce, and I don't agree with everything in this book, but there was an illustration in here that I thought was really, it struck me. And he said, the statement, "Thy will be done," he didn't say this, I'm paraphrasing, but the statement, "Thy will be done," will be made. The question is, who's going to say it? There's going to be a number of people that look to the Lord and say, "Thy will be done." And there's going to be a number of people, a higher percentage of people, that after time and time and time of trying to bring them to repentance, God's eventually going to wipe his hands and say, "Thy will be done." And that second will is the will of the person saying, "If you're not going to come to me, then you're going to receive damnation." A will be done, and "Thy will be done" will be said. But will it be a contrite heart? Will it be a bended knee saying it to the Lord? Or will it be the Lord wiping his hands clean and unfortunately saying, "Thy will be done," letting them to their own path of destruction? I'll leave those thoughts with you. If there's anything that this group can do for you, if you'd like to come forward and accept Christ as your Savior or bring anything before the group, please do so as we stand and sing the invitation song.